From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy, civil rights, and social issues affecting communities of color. I'm your co-host, Jordan Lawrence, Senior Manager of Communications.
And I'm Kim Atterbury, Senior Director of Communications and External Affairs.
And on this week's episode, we're discussing a silent epidemic that is killing Black women across the country and throughout the world, childbirth.
We know, because we've heard this repeatedly, that low incomes and a lack of access to healthcare results in poor health outcomes. Many people assume that when you earn more than the average American and have access to what's considered good healthcare, that your health outcomes, no matter race or gender, will be better. This is why it was probably so shocking when people learned tennis god Serena Williams had post-childbirth complications, largely due to her physicians not taking her concerns seriously. Despite her socioeconomic status, she was still subject to the same crisis and treatment as Black women lacking her resources and celebrity. Today, we're joined by Christy Gamble, former director of health policy for the Black Women Health Imperative, and our colleague, Nima Ako Brown, senior director of community and health wellness at the National Urban League. But before we begin, a message from Mark H. Morial, president and CEO of the National Urban League.
I'm Mark Morial, and this is your To Be Equal moment. Nearly 20 years ago, in the wake of what was then the worst school mass shooting, I led a bipartisan group of mayors urging Congress to pass major gun reform legislation. The Gun Violence Task Force of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, of which I was president, called for reforms including raising the minimum age for purchasing and possessing a handgun from 18 to 21, requiring background checks at gun shows, and limiting gun purchases to one a month per individual. As horrified as we were then, just after the Columbine shooting in 1999, we could not have imagined the next 19 years would not bring reforms, but even more lenient gun laws, another 200-plus school shootings, and more than 122 students, teachers, and coaches slain. Mass shootings garner headlines, but gun violence kills an average of 96 Americans every single day. We need reform at every level. The National Urban League supports a criminal background check for every gun sale. We support a renewal of the Public Safety and Recreational Firearms Use Protection Act, commonly known as the Assault Weapons Ban. We support measures to keep guns out of the hands of convicted domestic abusers. We support education, technology, and laws that keep guns out of the hands of children. And we support a strong federal trafficking law to crack down on illegal gun trafficking networks. For those of us who've been long engaged in this fight to reform our nation's gun laws, the movement that has arisen in the wake of last week's Parkland, Florida shooting has brought both inspiration and hope. Nothing, and I mean nothing, stands in the way of common sense reform but our own lack of courage and political will. The teenagers of Parkland have both, and we stand with them. I'm Mark Morial, and this has been your To Be Equal moment.
As we previously mentioned, today we're joined by Dr. Christy Gamble and Nima Ako Brown to discuss Black women's maternal health. These are two amazing women on the front lines of expanding healthcare access and equity for all. They are the real deal, y'all. I'm proud to call them friends. I'm proud to call them colleagues. And trust me when I say that we can all rest a little easier at night knowing these two women are in the movement and advocating on our behalf.
So, Dr. Christy Gamble and Ms. Nima Ako Brown, again, thank you for joining us. Let's jump right in. So, according to the Centers for Disease Control, 830 women die from pregnancy or child-related complications every day around the world. That's about 303,000 per year. In the United States alone, about 700 to 1,200 women die from pregnancy or childbirth complications annually. And the statistics for Black women are even more troubling, show that Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die of pregnancy or delivery complications than white women. Christy, if you could kick us off, why is this happening?
So this is really interesting. I definitely wanted to take a step back to talk about the definition for
maternal mortality, which happens when a mother dies from pregnancy-related complications while pregnant or within 42 days of birth. So those are the women that we're referring to here. So as you mentioned, there is a disparity when it comes to Black women. And unfortunately, it persists across all socioeconomic backgrounds, right? So that means this disparity does not discriminate, right? So educated and uneducated Black women are all suffering from high maternal mortality rates. So this puzzled many of us in the research world and advocates as to why all Black women are suffering, regardless of income level or education. And we thought about the fact that Black women are more likely to experience high rates of chronic conditions such as obesity and hypertension and diabetes, all which are risk factors for experiencing pregnancy-related complications. But what happens when we see healthy Black women? Healthy, educated, healthy weight, they work out. These same women are experiencing the same risk. And so it clicked to all of us. What we're seeing is chronic stress really impacting and taking a toll on Black women. And that chronic stress has to do with the racism and racial discrimination that Black women are faced with on a daily basis. So we know this country has a history of racial discrimination, institutional racism, and structural racism, which have negatively impacted Black women. So that is causing physiological responses within Black women that are causing them to have negative maternal health outcomes. So that's what we're seeing.
So how would you classify Black women dying at such high rates? Is this an epidemic or is this just malpractice?
We definitely see this as an epidemic, right? It's an epidemic across all women. But when it comes to Black women, it's truly an epidemic. We're seeing a trend here where in wealthy countries, we're seeing a decrease in maternal mortality rates. But in this country, we're seeing an increase, and Black women are dying giving birth. And so when you're talking about malpractice, right, in some cases you can say it's malpractice, right? Mm-hmm. The legal definition of malpractice is negligence. So a doctor has steered away from the standard of care here. The standard of care can result in a woman being harmed, and malpractice and negligence did not take place. Mm-hmm. So we need to make sure that we're not saying it's malpractice, but we know there's an epidemic occurring here.
And Nima Akko, how does implicit bias or cultural incompetence play in the treatment of Black mothers?
So implicit bias and cultural incompetence directly informs how clinicians deliver care. Recent studies have reiterated the fact that Black mothers consistently feel devalued and disrespected when receiving maternal health care. Bias and incompetence affect how clinicians approach pregnant women, from assuming a woman's marital status during prenatal appointments to how clinicians manage pain and listen to women's concerns during delivery and in the postpartum period. When Black women have to fight their clinicians to be heard, to have their birth plans respected, it makes what would and should be a joyous and healthy experience emotionally and physically challenging, and in worst case scenarios, very risky. And so in addition to implicit bias and cultural incompetence, historical legacies such as medical experimentation on slave women, coercive sterilization of poor women of color are factors that contribute to the mistrust of the healthcare system, rightfully so, by Black women. And it impacts how they engage with the medical system and how they accept care.
So knowing what we know, though, how can Black women adequately advocate for themselves when it seems as if the odds are stacked against us?
We can use our voices. We can leverage our collective knowledge. We can each one teach one to share information as we learn it, like in this podcast. We are the most educated, politically involved, business-building demographic in this country. Mm-hmm. And while the predominating statistics may be disheartening, there are women and organizations around the country doing critical work to cultivate women as self-advocates to receive the best care possible.
So Christy mentioned the high levels of stress that Black women deal with that impacts their maternal health outcomes. There's a professor at, I believe, the University of Michigan School of Public Health, Arlene Geronimus, and I'm not sure if I just butchered her last name, but forgive me if I did, that coined the term weathering. Can you explain this concept to listeners and how it contributes or puts us at greater risk for maternal health issues and potentially other health disparities?
Professor Geronimus has coined the term weathering, but it is problematic among the Black women who are engaged in this movement, in that while it attempts to explain how stress impacts negatively on birth outcomes, it fails to adequately identify and name the root causes of the stress that contributes to poor birth outcomes for women.
So let me just interrupt for a second. So What is weathering? What does she say weathering is?
So Geronimus says weathering is the deterioration of a woman's health as the result of socioeconomic disadvantages.
Okay. Okay.
However, a better way to describe the impact of stress and institutional racism on maternal health and health disparities is to think of Black women's health as a battery. So healthy eating habits, regular physical activity, having chronic conditions healthily managed, having safe, high-quality housing, making a living wage, having strong support systems, those all contribute to a Black woman having a full battery charge. When the stress of socioeconomic disadvantages takes a physical toll on the body, or in this case, drain power from the battery, it makes women more susceptible to having unhealthy pregnancies and unhealthy deliveries and unhealthy postpartum periods. And so circumstances such as limited access to quality health services, receiving high quality care from clinicians, those are all contributors to a drained battery.
And Christy, are there any other contributors that put us at greater risk for complications?
Yeah, and I would like to look to the Texas Task Force on Maternal Mortality and Morbidity, their report in October, because Texas has seen a doubling of their maternal mortality rate. So they convened a task force to come up with some recommendations, and they came up with a list of risk factors for women who suffer from maternal mortality. And it would include Black women over 40, being an unmarried woman, women who use Medicaid, pay insurance out of pocket, or have no insurance at all, and women who give birth through cesarean delivery. And they also included the traditional risk factors, which we hear about, which is entering your pregnancy with health problems such as obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, and smoking.
What research is being done around the country on the unique needs that Black women face in healthcare, and how is that research being translated into actual change?
So that's a good question, and unfortunately, there's not a lot. Definitely want to push for more, but I want to highlight one study in particular, which is the Black Women's Health Study, and that's been done at Boston University's Sloan Epidemiology Center. That followed 59,000 Black women since 1995 to look at all of their risk factors, to look at any diseases that they may suffer, how many develop lupus, breast cancer. But one really important point, which means they were way ahead of their time, one of the questions they asked was, do experiences of racism affect the occurrence of various illnesses in Black women? Mm-hmm. So this study is going to go on now until 2022. And we'll be able to get some of those answers that we've been looking for in research. But the unfortunate thing is no other women can enter this study since 1995. So we can't see really the impact of, say, for instance, this presidency of Donald Trump and the impact on Black women since he's been in office and these policies have been introduced.
So we talked about stress. We talked about contributors to poor health outcomes. And in some cases, one of those contributors is malpractice or physician neglect. So we've talked about what not so great healthcare looks like. What does good maternal health look like? Are there questions that women should ask or checklists that women should follow when in the care of an OBGYN or a doctor?
So can I jump in with what good maternal health looks like?
Yeah.
Access, right? Speaking from a policy perspective, access to affordable health care to ensure that women enter their pregnancy healthy, having access to that preventative health care, prenatal and postpartum care is key, and also mental health. We've been neglecting this in this conversation and the whole maternal mortality conversation where women are suffering from maternal mental health, especially Black women, at astronomical rates, but they're not getting the help that they need. Actually, Serena Williams actually said that in her article, but most people have neglected to talk about that. So proper mental health checks are needed. And also just being able to treat, manage, and maintain any conditions that Black women may have at that time as well.
And I just want to add that good maternal health also looks like providing all women with comprehensive, understandable information to make informed decisions. And so this can be achieved by providers checking any potential biases they may have and committing to providing high quality and culturally competent care. It means that treatment options are shared in appropriate languages and at appropriate literacy levels, and that women are connected to the necessary support services, such as mental and emotional services.
So I think that's a good point, because when when I think about what Black women are experiencing when it comes to maternal health and maybe just healthcare altogether, you know, we all know that there are biases that exist. We all know about these problems. So part of me, being the vocal person that I am, wants to know, should we as patients who often experience inequities in our healthcare and in our maternal care be direct in sharing with our physicians our concerns for bias, for poor birth outcomes, for postpartum hemorrhaging, and similar things on the onset of care?
Absolutely. And so one of the main things that that does for the clinician is automatically let them know that you are an informed patient. It lets them know that you will be a self-advocate and that you will engage in conversation with them about your care, about your treatment, and that you will not stand to be disrespected. You will not stand to have information not delivered to you in an adequate way. So absolutely, we should ask those questions and engage in conversation with our clinicians.
You wanted to add something, Kristen?
But isn't it sad that we have to do that?
Absolutely.
But patients that don't look like us can come and sit into a room and they're asked questions about a condition that they're not even there to see the patient that they're there to see the doctor for.
Yes.
So I think this lends well into talking about the fact that we need to be advocating to have more physicians of color put into the pipeline, right?
Absolutely.
Because when we have providers who look like us, they understand our lived experiences and they understand how we communicate, right? Mm-hmm. Because I hate when we have to put the onus on the patient for their health. That's not fair. They weren't trained in medical school. They need to have you, provider, as the one who was trained and who may be able to see things that I don't see, to tell me, hey, have you thought about the fact that you're so sad after your pregnancy or you're so stressed is maybe because you're dealing with postpartum depression. You know what I mean?
And even to go a step further and to look at how are medical students trained? So what are the curriculum requirements? What are the case studies? Oftentimes the case studies in medical school center around white heterosexual men. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean to have case studies that look at Black women, that look at Asian women, that look at Latina women? But so how do we go back to the medical training and say, are medical students trained to work with doulas? Are medical students trained to work with community health workers? Those are two evidence-based practices that have been shown to positively impact maternal health outcomes. But yet, most medical schools, I'm not going to say, but most medical schools do not include that in their training.
I like what you said about putting the onus on patients, because even in being direct, and I've had this experience personally when I had a recent surgery and I was in pain, and I know how they perceive us, right? And even though I was in pain, being hesitant to ask for pain medication. So it's while I know if I think about how I'm being perceived when I need healthcare, obviously other people are thinking about it. And unfortunately, yeah, it sometimes makes us hesitant to ask for the treatments that we need. You know, I mean, as Black people and particularly as Black women, you know, we're viewed a certain way. Sometimes we're viewed as being aggressive, being attitudinal. And so I think about, you know, when having a conversation at the onset with your physician or your OBGYN and, you know, saying like, hey, these are the things that I'm concerned about being taken seriously. But then, as you said, it goes back to cultural competency.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a fear among Black women, too, that we won't be believed if we say that we're in pain.
Right.
Because I know I read several threads on Twitter in preparation for this episode of women saying, you know, I went to the doctor because after I had my baby, was telling them I was in a lot of pain, and they said, oh, no, that's just typical, you know, post-birth
right.
pain you're going through.
Right.
Turns out they had like internal bleeding or like any other
right.
host of issues that they were dealing with, but they just weren't believed.
And sadly, yeah, that's been well documented, that there are Black women that have succumbed to complications during childbirth, during pregnancy, yeah, and in the postpartum period, because their doctor did not listen to their
right.
request for pain medication, to their sharing how they were feeling. One woman, you know, described that she was having trouble breathing. They just thought it was because she was obese, but in actuality, her lungs were filling with fluid. And so, again,
wow,
if medical doctors are not mm-hmm. trained, and if the onus is not put on them to be adequately understood in terms of what does it mean to provide culturally competent and care without bias, then that will continue to be a persistent issue.
Yeah. And I think we have to, because it's so is difficult to teach cultural, be really sensitive. And so I've been steering away from cultural competence because that's saying I meet the minimum requirement, right? So saying culturally appropriate and culturally sensitive. And mm-hmm. who can deliver that care? It's going to be people that look like yep. us, right? So I think we need to really think about this doulas, having Black midwives, mm-hmm. Black doulas, and having Black community workers be a part of the process.
Absolutely.
This whole interconnected care, right? This system where we can ensure that Black women have the supports around them to ensure that they're healthy and they're listened to and they're trusted. Because right now we're not seeing that.
Absolutely. And it's actually going back to how we as women of African descent have historically treated pregnancy, childbirth, and support in the postpartum period. Historically, it was the community midwife. It was the community women. Mm-hmm. When a woman went into labor, the midwife came and she was supported by the other women in the community. The midwife stayed. That midwife had upteen years of experience in delivering natural births. Mm-hmm. Sadly, most obstetricians and obstetricians have not had as much experience in delivering natural births.
Wow.
Their experience are in C-sections and high-risk pregnancies. Mm. And so studies show that midwives deliver higher quality obstetric care because of their experience in natural childbirth, mm-hmm. in being able to provide physical and emotional supports during the labor and delivery process. Studies have shown the impact of that doulas have. So when you have a clinical care team for Black women that comprises a well-versed, culturally sensitive, culturally aware physician that looks like her, when there's a midwife, a doula, that's, again, what good maternal health care looks like, being able to have access to all of those types of clinicians to be able to deliver safely and healthily.
Absolutely. So that leads me to two questions. So, Christy, you talked about making sure there's a pipeline, and I might be jumping ahead because I know we want to talk about potential policy solutions, mm-hmm. but creating a pipeline of physicians that look like us or caregivers that look like us, how do we do that?
You know, that actually starts in elementary school. Right. I know people always talk about medical school or residency, but we need to go way further back. We need to start talking about STEM, and we need to have effective programs, not programs that look nice on advertisements on people's websites, but ones that truly reach the community. Right. So it's going to take physicians who are already there, physicians of color, going into those schools and saying, look, I did this. You can do this, too. Kind of like what we're seeing with Obama. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of kids believe that they can actually be present. So we need to start educating young people and having quality schools that serve, unfortunately, predominantly Black and brown mm-hmm. kids, and making sure that we set them up well, even if that's an after school program or if it's, you know, some type of supplemental charter school type of program. But we need to do something, and we need to do something now. We need solutions instead of talking, because that's what we're hearing.
And for that to be consistent. So planting the seed in elementary school, because if a young Black student is not captured into the STEM by third or fifth grade, yep. they're more likely not going to gain interest into that. Mm-hmm. So you have to plant the seed, kindergarten, first, second grade, water that seed through elementary school, continue to water and feed that nurturing plant while they're in middle school to maintain that interest. And then especially in those critical high school years, support them to maintain that interest and ensure that when they get to college, that the supports are there for that Black student to be able to successfully make it through college and then through medical school and through residency. So again, as Christy mentioned, it's starting at the root and planting the seed, but having the systems in place to nurture that seed to a healthy tree that then bears fruit of more clinicians of color to provide high quality care.
Right, right.
And I'm sure it also goes to not steering kids towards certain fields too. Because a lot of times when we talk about STEM, we talk about tech. So you want people to go work at Google or YouTube or Facebook or these large tech companies, or we're steering them towards engineering. But it's rare that we hear of STEM in, you know, helping people learn about health services and things like that.
Absolutely. Right. And that includes medical doctors, so being an OBGYN, that includes being nurse practitioners, that includes being midwives, mm-hmm. that includes being doulas. Yeah. So how do we offer up all of these avenues to our young people as viable options to be servants to their community? To say, yes, absolutely, be a doctor if that's what you want to be, but understand that there are also other options to be able to contribute to your community.
That's right.
Niamako, something that you mentioned a little earlier was about, you said something to the effect of doctors not being trained or having a lot of experience in natural births, and they have a lot of experience in C-sections, which made me think about maybe some of my friends and their experiences, that they're all of a certain age, which is, you know, maybe mid to late 30s. Many of them are just having their children for the first time, but all of them consistently receive C-sections. And, you know, I found that to be curious, but having you here, is there a reason why? Are C-sections, what are the risks? Is there some sort of bias why these doctors are administering C-sections?
So there are studies, there are documented increases in the rates of C-sections across racial ethnic groups in the last 10 to 15 years. And that is largely due to many of the challenges that we face in our healthcare delivery system in terms of how doctors are compensated. And so doctors receive more money for performing C-sections. C-sections. Another contributing factor is that C-sections are more convenient for the doctor, and that for a woman to labor naturally, again, you have to trust the woman. Mm-hmm. You have to trust her body to be able to go through this natural process in a time frame that's healthy for her and healthy for the baby. C-sections can be scheduled. C-sections are in a more controlled environment.
Right.
And so there has been a shift to clinicians doing more C-sections. Now, while I do have a master's in public health, I'm not a trained clinician, so I don't want to speak to if there are any clinical reasons why doctors may be performing more C-sections. But in my work and in my research, I have seen that there has been a significant spike in the number of C-sections that are performed. And again, by virtue of age, clinicians will deem a woman to be high risk. And so, again,
that
performing
justifies.
That justifies the C-section. But again, C-sections are major surgery.
Yes.
There are a whole host of complications that can arise from C-sections, whether it's hemorrhaging, whether it's blood clots, whether it's infection. And so those can have irreparable damage on the mother and on the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are other connective processes that are disrupted during C-sections, because now the mother and the baby don't have the opportunity to immediately bond post-delivery, which again impacts maternal and infant health outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
It impacts breastfeeding in terms of how soon a woman can begin breastfeeding due to any antibiotics that she may be on as a result of the C-section.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, there has definitely been a spike in C-sections among all women, but especially among Black women.
Hmm.
Isn't that interesting? I wonder if we can look at that spike and compare it to the increase that we've seen in maternal mortality rates, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Because one of the risk factors for experiencing maternal mortality
and morbidity.
Exactly, is C-sections. So that's really interesting how we've seen that spike in both,
mm-hmm.
but no one's talked about how they are related. Interesting.
Niamako, you mentioned you have your master's in public health, but you also lead community and health and wellness for the National Urban League. What does that mean? And do we have any programs or services that help expectant mothers?
So in my role, I direct the health programs that the National Urban League funds our affiliates to implement. I help inform our health policy efforts. I provide technical assistance and capacity building support to our over 90 affiliates, in addition to representing the National Urban League externally in health spaces and on task force. And so a number of our South Florida affiliates provide breastfeeding support for new mothers. A number of our affiliates, including Essex County, New Jersey, are home to Head Start programs, which provide comprehensive quality early childhood education, which includes supportive services for parents. And our affiliates do a substantial amount of work in housing services and workforce development, including utility assistance. And so those areas address the social determinants of health that can negatively impact women's health, including expecting and parenting mothers. And so if an affiliate may not have specifically designated programming for expectant mothers, many of the services that our affiliates offer can help to support a new mother, a pregnant woman, a parenting woman, to provide the healthiest and safest environment for her and her children.
So as we begin to kind of wind down, I want to ask you both first, based on what we share today, should we be afraid? Right. And then the second question is to Christy, are there specific policy solutions that could abate or stem many of these issues? Should we be afraid?
Yes.
Absolutely.
I am. As a black woman in America.
Yes. So I'm going to say, as a proud 32-year-old college and master's educated level black woman, this is an issue that hits so close home because it's me. This is me.
Right.
So this means that when I get pregnant for the first time, I'm at a higher risk to lose my life or my baby's life just by the virtue of the color of our skin. That's terrifying. Mm-hmm. But there's also power in that and understanding that I have the capacity to do the best that I can to ensure that I and my child have the best outcome. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's engaging in conversations like this, whether it's identifying clinicians and practitioners that look like me, my primary care is a black woman nurse practitioner who is awesome. But again, it's identifying ways to take those steps and also knowing that I can share this information with the next black woman that may not have the same access to information that I do. So that way, not only am I improving my chances of a healthy outcome, but I'm improving the chances of a healthy outcome for my sisters in the movement.
So I always say knowledge is power, but it's also scary. So mm-hmm. as a woman in her 30s who is about to get married and about to have a husband who wants to have some kids, I am terrified. I'm absolutely terrified. I know too much right now to know that even, as you said, an educated black woman, I may not have the same birthing outcome as a white colleague. So it terrifies me. I always say to people when we talk about this issue that, you know, to be a black woman and pregnant in America is to have a death sentence. And that's terrifying to me. And while it does bring me some joy knowing that I'm in this space, like spreading word and knowledge, if we can't change the way things are being done and the policies that are impacting black women's health, we're going to continue to see this going a downward spiral.
Mm-hmm. So are there policy solutions to address or abate this?
Yes. And I'm going to try to say it fast.
Is that the good news or no?
Well, you know, I definitely want to say that women's health has not been a priority lately. We've had, you know, a room full of white men deciding what is important for women. But we need to start seeing more policies that particularly speak to the mother's health, right? We're not seeing maternal and child health block grants, majority of that funding going towards mothers, only 6%. So that's what we need to see some increases. But California, who's always my hero, they actually developed this, it's called the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative, which some states have adopted already. And it's to have enhanced safety protocols in place, right? So they train hospitals on what emergencies to look for and what processes they need to refine to ensure that women are adequately attended to if an emergency arises. So only a few states have adopted that. We need to make that a national national policies. And then also, I don't know if y'all have heard, but there are studies done, particularly in New York, where they did a study against black serving hospitals, where there's 90% of their patients are black. So they call them black serving. So high black serving hospitals versus low black serving hospitals. We're noticing that maternal mortality rates are 50% higher in those black serving hospitals.
Wow.
And so one of the authors said that if black women went to the same hospital and delivered at the same hospitals as white women, their risk would decrease by 50%. So we need to start talking about policies to ensure that every single person, every mother has access to quality, safe, and comprehensive maternal care. So that means Medicaid. Expanding Medicaid. That means getting rid of these work requirements with Medicaid,
right,
and forcing women to go back to work 60 days after they've given birth and making sure people have access to that affordable health care, which is through the ACA. So those are the policies I think we definitely need to have in place. We've spoken about other ones, about the pipeline,
right,
and then doulas and midwife, you know, after the smear campaigns that have prevented certification of black women from getting into these programs, we need to make sure that we look at access to affordable health care.
How can organizations like the National Urban League and other community-based nonprofits work to raise awareness of and eliminate the health disparities that black women face?
One of the things that I like to highlight is to elevate community effective community-based solutions. So there are community-based organizations that have experienced success in improving health outcomes for Black women. And so most of those are community-based organizations that provide doulas at either free or low cost to women. Most of them have sliding scale, so mm-hmm. women pay what they can afford. And so that has been one of the strongest solutions I've seen to addressing Black women's maternal health concerns. And that's often because, again, those doulas look like them. Those doulas live in the same communities in which they live. So they know how and can best inform on how to overcome many of the barriers and the challenges to receiving high quality care, or even just dealing with the social stressors of being a Black woman in this country. And so when you have a doula who is someone that's there during your prenatal labor and delivery and postpartum period, that's by your side, that knows your wishes, that can help you advocate and communicate to your primary provider, those are critical.
Yeah, and I like to say that this podcast is a great start, right? So, but my fear is that this will become a fleeting issue, right? Vogue magazine will come out with a new issue and we'll forget about the Serena Williams right. story. So, you know, my ask for organizations like Urban League is to continue to talk about the issue, continue to talk about Black women's health, to get men talking about Black women's health. Because when it's just women, you know, unfortunately, these issues are never elevated and highlighted. But it takes Urban League linking it with other issues such as the election. We need to hold our elected officials and candidates for the midterm. We need to hold their feet to the ground, right? And ask them about Black women's health. How do you feel about Black women's health? And then once we see that they don't have an answer, that's someone that we don't need to vote for.
That's a good point.
And also, I want to add that addressing the systemic issues that contribute to the poor outcomes for Black women. So organizations like the National Urban League, using our voice, mm-hmm. using our national voice, using our national policy voice, again, to elevate the conversation and keep the conversation going. Additionally, when you have national organizations and large nonprofits, we can call out the players in this. So how do we have effective conversations with our partners in the federal government? How do we have these high-level conversations with our private partners, including hospital systems, to say, hey, we recognize the problem. We're doing what we can on our part, but this is what you should be doing. This is how you can actively engage in this fight to save Black women's lives.
Absolutely.
You both shared some very important information today, but what is your final call to action for the movement?
Or was that it?
No. I would say talk to each other, share information, ask questions. Don't approach your healthcare as a solo endeavor. Support effective community-based organizations and call out your politicians.
That was such a nice answer. So I'm going to go in.
Please.
And I'm going to say we have to stop skirting around the issue. We have to talk about the impact of racism and racial discrimination on Black people, people of color, immigrants. We have to talk about these issues. We are charged with, we are educated, so we're blessed to have the education and the jobs that we have. We can't sit by and do nothing, right? And if we do, then we have the bloods of Black women and their babies on our hands. That's all I have to say.
Well, thank you both for joining us today. So, Christy, if folks want to get in contact with you or follow you on social media, how do they do that?
Oh, that's great. I have a Twitter account only, at Chris Michelle, at Chris Michelle 13. That's C-H-R-I-S, capital M-I-C-H-E-L-L-E 13.
And Nima Akko?
I can be found at Nima Akko Brown, MPH, on both Instagram and Twitter. So that's Nima Akko, N as in Nancy, I, M as in Mary, A-A-K-O, Brown, M as in Masters, P as in Public, H as in Health, all one word, on both Instagram and Twitter.
Thank you both.
Thank you
for what you're doing in and for
Thank
the
you.
Movement.
Thank you.
This week, we're shouting out the Louisville Urban League for releasing their State of Black Louisville report. It's a collection of essays detailing how African Americans are doing in the city when it comes to jobs, justice, education, health, and housing. The Louisville Urban League says this publication is a roadmap to addressing longstanding inequality for the Black community and could help pave the way for greater progress. It's a localized version of the National Urban League's annual State of Black America report, which captures how African Americans are faring nationwide compared to other ethnicities and offers policy solutions. Copies of the State of Black Louisville report are available for order online at loul.org. As always, you can follow us on all social media at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Play. Kudos to our communications and policy team here at the Washington Bureau and our editing team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to National Urban League's For the Movement. See you next week.